Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, but a guest who's more and more frequent here on the show, the gold-plated insurance plan of the education policy world, Andy Smerick.
Hey, Mike. Welcome back. Hello, everyone.
Thank you. I want you to know that the coup that took place last week is now over. I am restoring power over this show. But no, I just joke. Thank you for taking the reins last week. Much appreciated.
It was great. Lots of fun. And Stafford stepped up and did a fantastic job. The B team here is ready to get promoted to the majors.
Oh, yeah. I understand. We are superfluous. That's fine. We can all be replaced. Well, Rick and I were both in Philadelphia, though I actually did not see Rick while I was there. We were both had some speaking gigs at the National Conference of State Legislators meeting.
Your blog about how your speech was taken was pretty funny. I liked it.
Thanks. Well, yes. It was a tough crowd. I mean, so Andy, for people that didn't read that blog post, here's basically the situation. I knew I was speaking to state legislators, mm-hmm. and NCSL has a reputation as being not that friendly towards reform.
Right.
So I figured it would be a tough crowd. But what I didn't expect was for not one, not two, not three, but at least four of the people that asked questions to be both state legislators and classroom teachers and NEA members.
Pretty amazing, isn't it?
I mean, so the NEA is not only running their own candidates who support their views, they are running their own members and getting them elected to the legislature.
You got to be impressed by their gall and their effectiveness. Yeah. I mean, I'd actually like to see some data on this, Amber. It would be neat to see like what percentage of different state legislatures are made up of members of the teaching profession, but also then to see if it varies by part-time legislators, mm-hmm. legislatures, or geographic regions and so forth. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Pennsylvania or New York has a non-trivial amount of their legislators.
No, I've heard from people since I wrote that saying, yeah, this is what happens in our state too. I heard from some people in Minnesota saying this is definitely teachers. There's a big block of teachers or former teachers in the legislature, and you know there's about 7,300 state legislators out there across mm-hmm. the country. At one point, you tried to become one of them.
I did.
I even knocked on some doors for you, Andy. I think lost you some votes.
No, you didn't. We came close. Maybe sometime down the line.
And we were celebrating. We were like, oh, Andy Smerick almost becomes a legislator who actually has helped to found a charter school. I mean, we can put on one hand the number of charter school people and bona fide educational reformers who have gotten themselves elected to these offices.
Yeah, we have Mike Johnston in Colorado now, and then after that,
that might be
fewer and fewer and fewer.
Well, yes, that's right. Well, Michael Bennett, who is now in the U.S. Senate, that counts for something.
But it's actually interesting, the TFA generation who are taking over in school districts and doing some other things. I'd like to talk to their alumni folks and see how many of TFA alum have actually gone on to run for office.
Well, you know, they have a division focused just on that.
On running for office?
Oh, yeah. But they've had some successes, but it's mostly been pretty small-time offices so far.
I think someone got elected here to the school board in D.C. Mm-hmm. Was that right?
Julie
Makuta.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can't just blather on about this forever, Andy, because we have a lot to cover today.
We got business.
We got a full cast back here today, so it's a full show, everybody. Hey, just because it's summertime doesn't mean we slack off around here, you know? And it doesn't mean there's not education news to be had. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to rate that reform. And we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. So, Mickey, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
President Obama and Secretary Duncan released the Race to the Top application last week. Was it a slam dunk or an air ball for education reform?
Well, it was more like a tough 18-foot jumper. So it was good, even very good, not great, probably. So I have some quibbles about what they actually used for the eligibility criteria. I would have liked to see them get tougher on there. I think they went too far on the national common standards. But when it came to teacher quality and charter schools, they actually did some really good things. And Mike and I both agree that they were... I'll use the word prescriptive, and maybe we can talk more about this, but the fact that they have a sense that they know what's best and that all of the answers are out there, and if we just, in the Secretary's words, have courage that everything will be hunky-dory, and I think we need to show a little bit more modesty on that front. So good, even very good, but we have to keep pushing in some areas.
Well, I'm going to call a foul on this play. No, I think Andy and I agree on a lot of this. I mean, the reforms in that package are, by and large, good, solid reforms that I support and think are good ideas. I think we have to be honest that there's not a lot of evidence behind them. In some cases, because we haven't been allowed to try them anywhere. In other cases, because they're new, promising but certainly not proven ideas. And so I think the secretary and the president have been somewhat dishonest about that. But I do worry about the heavy-handed approach. Basically, what the administration has done is said, if you want some of this money, then you need to do as many of these 19 reform ideas of ours as possible. Rather than saying to the states, hey, give us your best reform ideas, and we will have a competition with smart people to decide which of the ones are most compelling and most promising. So you've got a situation where states are going to be punching boxes, and if there's anything we've learned from No Child Left Behind, it should be this. You can force states to do things they don't want to do, but you cannot force them to do those things well. And a lot of the stuff on the list is stuff that has to be done well, with a lot of nuance, with real heart and soul. And I think if you have states out there doing it just to get the money and their heart's not in it, I think you could end up seeing a mess that, you know, my friend Rick Hess has said, look, this could do to charter schools and some of these other reforms what No Child Left Behind did to accountability, which is sort of, you know, kill it with kindness.
Well, there's one interesting thing that we should point out that I think gets to your concern about not being able to force states to do things they don't want to do. The application guidelines actually break down two types of things that the department will be looking for. Not only, so one, what does the state put in its application? So what is it claiming it wants to do? But then also, what does the state policy environment actually say? So do you have good charter school cap rules? Do you have good performance pay rules? So those things should actually indicate whether or not these states like Florida or Pennsylvania, who might be at the top of the list, actually have shown in advance that they care about these reforms and they're not just searching for money. So the fact that the department have these two levels, what does your policy environment look like and what does your application look like, I think was a smart thing to do, and it's going to lead to some good results, hopefully.
Always optimistic, Andy.
That's right. No cynicism for me.
All right, Mickey. Topic number two.
All right. Fordham has a new primer out today about graduation rates and why they are so hard to pin down. It concludes with a look at the brewing debate, whether high schools should be held accountable for boosting their graduation rates. So, should they?
Generally, I think the answer is no. And yet, this was one of the greatest failures of Andy's tenure at the Department of Education. He was there in the last year of the Bush administration when they implemented this crazy regulation. Now, look, here's the deal. You know, there's been a lot of debate for a long time about how to measure graduation rates. We are finally to the point where there seems to be some consensus. The states under the NGA agreed to measure it in a common way. New Title I regulations that came out in Spellings last month on the job said, okay, that's the way we're going to do it from the federal level as well. And so this is now we have a pretty much an agreement on how we're going to measure graduation rates. That's good. That should get us more honest data. But now what Spellings did is she went ahead and said, however, you've got to now include in your determinations about whether or not high schools make adequately early progress, you've got to include whether they are meeting targets for graduation rates, not just for kids overall, but for the separate subgroups, so Black, Hispanic, et cetera, et cetera. What you've done is overnight you've made it very hard for many schools, high schools in the country, to make AYP because their graduation rates, particularly for poor minority kids, are so low. Now, all that says, okay, fine, we want to increase those graduation rates. The problem is if you put too much pressure on getting more kids across the finish line in order to make AYP, there's all kinds of perverse incentives for schools and states to redefine what it means to be a high school graduate. And already you see this in places around the country where there's these, you know, multiple pathways to getting a degree, many of which look very fishy, where, you know, people are trying to make it easier to get across to that finish line. And so I worry we push too hard on the metric and on graduation rates getting up. We're going to push on the other end in terms of what it means to be a graduate.
So Mike is right about a couple things here. And what I'll say is actually from my time in the government when we were working on this stuff.
I knew it.
Well, so I actually got to deal with this both when I was at DPC and then at the White House. And this is actually really tough business. So I encourage people listening to this to take a look at the new Fordham report on this, because trying to figure out what a graduation rate means is actually tougher than you would think. And the report goes into this. So what does it count to succeed? How much time can you, is it 4 years or 5 years? What happens if you get held back? These are tough questions, and these are the things that the U.S. Department of Education during my time there actually wrestled with when we got comments back and thinking, what's the right way to handle this? So the first thing is to admit that this isn't simple to figure out the right thing. But I think the more important aspect is, if you're thinking about outputs in American education, reading scores are fine and math scores are fine and safety is very important, but graduation is extremely important. So if we're going to have an accountability system where we're actually going to hold schools and their teachers accountable for getting certain results, I would put graduation rates up there. So once we decide on the metric, it seems senseless to me to then somehow, you know, put it to the side and say, yeah, it's too hard to measure, we don't want to actually do this.
Well, it's not too hard to measure, Andy, but it's very simple. If you say schools, you have got to get your graduation rate up, they will find ways to do that that don't actually mean getting kids across to a standard diploma in a standard way. They will find ways. They will pass kids who got 59 instead of a 60. They will do all kinds
of things. So that's an argument against all accountability, though, because you could say that about test scores. You could say that about graduation. You could say that about safety stats. So, I mean, if you use that argument, you have to explain to me why you think any accountability makes sense.
Well, that's a good segue into topic number three.
Chicken.
All right.
I'll get back to that.
Okay. Florida officials see evidence that some schools are teaching canned phrases to students to be spit out on the writing portion of the state test. The state doesn't consider this practice technically cheating, but is starting policy discussions to decide appropriate consequences when this sort of practice is identified. Should it be considered cheating, and what should be done about it?
All right. So, see, this ties right in with this comments that we were having before. Okay. So, anytime, I do support accountability. I do think it makes sense to try to look at results. But we have to acknowledge that anytime you do that, whatever you start to measure, you're going to have this risk of people playing games around. Okay, so you've got to anticipate that. You put some guidelines in place. I also think that we need to have a clear idea of what cheating means. Right now, if you have places where people are teaching to the test in a very narrow way, where they are, you know, all they're doing all day long is having kids write, you know, these three sentence little paragraphs because that's what they have to write on the state test. That should be considered unethical practice as an educator. You should be disbarred or you should be kicked out of schools if you are found to be doing that sort of thing. One thing we can do is make the test better. So that's how you fix it with testing, is you improve the quality of the test. But I think we also need to have some greater sense in this profession and this education system of what is ethical, what is considered to be a practice that we find acceptable, and what crosses the line.
Good answer. So the specific question here about if you're going to have written responses as opposed to just marking in some Scantron ABCD, the difficult, I mean, human beings are the ones who are grading these. And if you're going to grade a DBQ on an AP U.S. history exam on the New Deal and someone doesn't use the phrase, doesn't say Roosevelt or doesn't say the New Deal or doesn't say whatever else or court packing, then chances are that's not going to be a very good response. So we have to give the people grading these things some sort of cues of what things to look for. Of course, you know, that can just have the snowball effect, and you can only grade all these exams just based on these little phrases, and teachers could only teach to that. But I don't have any general specific concern about taking a look at these specific phrases. This story didn't really worry me all that much. I remember actually my high school AP U.S. history teacher talking about if you get a question about the settlement of Maryland and Virginia, you should actually use the term second sons, because that's something that the graders of the AP exam will be looking for. I didn't think that was cheating, but it was a cue that we knew what we were talking about. So if there's anyone out there, if there is anyone out there who has graded AP exams, actually real responses, I'd like to hear from you. To what extent are you told these cues that you look for in the exam, and then how do you build that into your larger grading scale?
That's right. Andy can be reached at cheater@cheater.com. Just kidding, Andy. All right. Well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly, Cheater. It is now time for Amber's Research Minute.
Welcome back, Amber.
Thank you very much.
Great to see you.
It's a meaty show today. I hope I can bring it.
That's right. You know, Amber, when I'm not on the show or Rick's not on the show, nobody seems to notice. But when you're gone, we get all kinds of letters saying, no, what happened? So your fans are very excited to have you back.
Feels good. All right. You timing me?
I'm timing you.
All right, this week we have a new study out by the Center on Education Policy that examines whether there is a plateau effect in state test scores, meaning a tapering off of scores after large gains. If it exists, this would undermine states' ability to reach ever-increasing annual performance targets. So researchers analyzed 55 trend lines from 16 states. Each state had 6 to 10 years of test data and met various criteria, such as not changing their test or their cut scores for proficiency. They found 15 of the 55 trend lines showed a plateau pattern for percent proficient, 21 showed steady increases, 19 showed up and down patterns. Importantly, the largest gains were just as likely to occur between the third and fourth years, or the fifth and sixth years, as they were to occur between years one and two. The largest gains in percent proficient in all states, however, occurred between years 2003 and 2004, 2 years after NCLB took effect. Most states had in place the same test several years prior to NCLB, so the authors hypothesize that test results can spike when even higher stakes are introduced, which seems reasonable.
This is an interesting study, but let me ask this. I'm always confused about some of these recent CEP studies. You know, we're looking at proficiency levels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one way of looking at trend line. So basically, you know, every year, are we able to get more and more and more kids over the proficiency bar? And mm-hmm. that's relevant to NCLB, mm-hmm. certainly. But that's not the only way to look at a plateau, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wouldn't you also want to look at the sort of average scale scores and see whether they, you know, in the first years of a test administration, you know, first couple of years, you expect them to go way up. Well, and then, so we really don't know from this whether that kind of plateauing is happening.
That's right. Hmm. Yep, they just were looking at percent proficient.
Did they make that clear in the study?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was very straightforward. I didn't have any problems with the methods, and they've got a really good panel of advisors giving them advice.
So policy-wise, what should we take away from this?
Well, I think, you know, one of the points they made was, you know, is the premise that, you know, these kids are going to be able to reach proficiency with these AYP targets. You know, are we setting them up for failure? And I think what this said was, you know, we're not. I think the research in the 80s and 90s, there was a study in Florida that really, you know, showed this huge plateau effect. But I think some interesting things have happened with tests. I mean, one is, you know, in the 80s and 90s, lots of states used the exact same format with the same items. And we're a little smarter about it now. We use different forms of the same tests where the items have been, you know, shown to test at the same cognitive, you know, levels. And they've been equated with one another through some pretty advanced, you know, psychometric techniques. So, you know, we can't really talk about plateaus now like we did in the 80s and 90s because we're a little smarter about the way we administer tests.
But again, I'm not sure that back then, I think we were talking about a different kind of plateau back then.
Meaning?
Right? That we were looking at average scale scores.
Yeah.
Right. You know, were average scores going up as dramatically in out years as in the first couple of years?
Yeah.
So again, I think that's true because what this says is, okay, every year schools are they continue to be able to get another chunk of kids over mm-hmm. the bar that weren't over the bar last year,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than saying whether or not the average scores are still going up at a rapid pace.
Right. And I think, you know, the other thing, too, it's really hard to tell because even, you know, they look at most of these were 6 years, and that's really not a very long trend line anyway, you know, and when they said only a very tiny number of states have given the same test over 10 years, which is understandable, and they, you know, that's probably a good thing.
And to pile on one more thing, we do know from Fordham's proficiency illusion that these
nice
even
plug.
When states don't try to change their cut scores, the difficulty of these tests can get easier, sometimes harder over time, and
right.
so that can
but
be
they were they excluded those. I mean, they didn't. They made sure they kept the same test. They made sure they didn't change their cut scores. I mean, they
right. but again, yeah. They can say they're not changing their cut scores, but we still found that, you know, that the state test
right.
could get easier over time.
You mean the content of the test?
Yeah.
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 Sure. Absolutely.
All right. So what is the song that we're going to
talk about? Well, we're talking about reaching plateaus. So we have The Climb by Miley Cyrus, a.k.a. Hannah Montana.
Very nice.
That's our big hit. Isn't that a big hit?
Was this as Miley or was this as Hannah?
It came out as with Miley. I think she's trying to downplay the Hannah Montana thing in her singing career.
Yes. Career.
Good in quotes.
How old is she? 16?
I have no clue.
Thank you, Amber. That's great.
Career. All right. Amber's Research Minute. Now, let's rate that reform.
Rate that reform.
Okay, Stafford, it's summer. It's hot. School's not in session. What the heck are we going to rate today?
Nice setup.
We are talking about parties, specifically teacher parties at the end of the year. So a few teachers of school in, I don't know how to pronounce this, but Wyandotte, Michigan, threw an end of the year party, and they rented out some space at the local golf course for their annual soiree, presumably hoping to keep it classy. Fortunately, this bash turned into a kegger, and the district has started an investigation into the evening's events. On the list of offenses are indecent exposure, public urination, misuse of district funds, to apparently buy the booze. So what can I say? This chain of decisions was just poor in every respect. And though I would like to maintain the reign of the summer gentleman C, I have to give this one an F.
Were federal stimulus funds used, you think, to fund this party?
That's a really good one. I don't know.
Funds are all fungible.
If there's a budget line item for end of school parties, and there was a hole in that little budget line item, federal funds could have been used.
Now, hold on. I feel like the two of you are being a little unfair to teachers. Now, we know, let's say in the heyday of the Wall Street craziness, that Wall Street firms would have holiday parties, and they'd blow it out with all kinds of money, spending all kinds of booze, right? I mean, this is, even here at Fordham, we have a holiday party, and we serve alcohol, and we, you know, we...
Do you use public money?
No. Are you saying you can never use public funds for a teacher party?
No, I'm saying
that if you bought donuts for the teachers, right?
You can't buy alcohol with public dollars and expose yourself and urinate public.
What's the rule? Like, there's no rule that says you can't buy alcohol with public dollars.
Yeah, I think there is. I don't know what kind of Department of Education you were working for.
I know we didn't at the federal level, but I'm just not sure there's an ironclad rule that you can never, ever, ever.
All right, maybe people.
I'm just saying, look, in lots of other professions, people get to have parties.
There's nothing wrong with parties.
And I think it's just a shame that
it's public money. People are allowed to party. I think we concede that, right, Stafford? Mm-hmm. People can party, just not on my dime.
Okay, but you don't mind.
Unless it's my party.
But you don't mind if they use your dime to buy, I don't know, heart attack inducing donuts, for example. It's just that you draw a distinct line between alcohol and other substances that will eventually kill you.
That's a good point. I'll have to write a list.
All right. You write a regulation about that, Andy.
That will do.
All right. That's all the time we got. I appreciate everybody being here. Andy, thanks again for being on the show.
It's always fun. Thanks for having me.
It's so fun giving you a hard time.
That's great.
Till next week.
I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.